From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on June 10th of last year at Whitehaven Cemetery. You'll find a new memorial there, the Gold Star Families Memorial. And there's a story behind how it came together that we think you should hear on this Memorial Day. Our guests are Barry Culhane and John White, two men who helped lead the effort to get the memorial funded and built, and two men who served our country in Vietnam. So let's get to it. Hello, Barry Culhane. Welcome back to the program. It's always nice to have you here.
Likewise, Evan. I always enjoy being with you.
Well, and we're going to talk about your service. You've served the community in many ways, but I want to go all the way back to some of your service as well in a different way. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. John White, a U.S. Marine Corps veteran and a committee treasurer for the Rochester Gold Star Families Memorial, who also has a remarkable personal story, though I can already tell about you, John. You'd rather talk about others. I know your type. I've seen him over the years. But we're gonna pull some of your own story out of you. Thank you for being here, John.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks for having us.
You know, we're going to be talking about this remarkable memorial out at Whitehaven. And I was, you know, just reading it roughly a year ago is when finally finished, right? Is that about right, in June?
It was dedicated on 10 June 2016. And I was kind of interested. Barry and I looked back, and the first meeting that we had to start discussing the prospect of all of this was July of 2014. So it was a two-year run.
And here you are now with a year under your belt with it. It was the 10th. Rochester's was the 10th such memorial, but there's 20 in New York State now, and there's plans, John, for 34 total. Is that right?
Actually, we were the 10th in the country.
Oh, 10th in the country.
Country, thanks. Not in the state. We were the 10th in the country, and the progression of these memorials has been quite rapid. There are 20 as we sit here today, and under construction by the end of 2017. Mm-hmm. Barry, I think I'm right. There'll be 34 states represented, and the dream of the founder, Barry, you can go into that, but Woody Williams, who actually initiated this whole idea of a Gold Star Families Memorial, his dream is to have a memorial in every state. He's 96 years old.
Wow.
So he started this, Evan, at 90 years old and said, you know, I think that we focus too much on just Gold Star mothers. And he tells the story of being in a meeting in Chicago, giving a presentation and to the Gold Star family mothers, which has been around for a long time. My grandmother was one. I remember at 6 them coming to the house and telling us that my Uncle Bill, who's still missing from Korea, was gone. But it used to be just Gold Star mothers. And somebody came up to Woody afterwards and said, you know, Gold Star fathers cry too. And I guess it moved him so much that he decided that he was going to expand Gold Star concept to all family members, and then he wanted to build a memorial in every state of the union. This is at 90 years old, and this guy, who's very articulate, tremendous to speak with, earned his Medal of Honor as a Marine in Iwo Jima, and is still going strong in support of veterans and their families.
Hmm. It seems like a logical comment or a logical idea that, you know, Gold Star mothers we certainly honor, but it's not just Gold Star moms who grieve. You agree?
And that's absolutely right. It's mothers, it's fathers, it's uncles, it's siblings. You know, Gary Bykirk is the one who came to my home with Scott Santillo just before we started meeting and said, Barry, would you mind working on another memorial? And I said, well, I'm not quite so sure I want to do this, but he had me hooked, and so John was quick to get on board, as well as a number of other really fine individuals that represent different groups like Blue Star Mothers and fellow veterans. So it was a labor of love. It was $90,000 we thought we needed. We ended up spending $110,000, and it's beautiful. It's elegant. It's simple, and we were really pleased to see Gold Star mothers and fathers and families come out in September. The last Sunday in September is National Gold Star Families Day.
Well, on this Memorial Day, as we observe this Memorial Day, listeners, if you want a chance to see it, as we mentioned, it's at Whitehaven Cemetery, but I want to make sure you know exactly where to go. And then I've got some questions about the memorial itself. But John, you're there quite often. You said you're not far from it, so you get a chance to spend some time there.
I spent quite a bit of time there.
And so people are going to be going to Whitehaven to find it. Where do they go?
Because Whitehaven can be overwhelming in terms of its size. But as you pull in the main entrance to Whitehaven, there's a circle that you immediately confront. And you just turn right around the circle, go straight out the other side of it, and straight back by the All Seasons Chapel. Many people are very familiar with the All Seasons Chapel, and it's right across the street. And so there's plenty of parking. It's quite obvious. As you drive up and approach it, you can see the memorial there. There are four panels in an angular shape, and it's very, very easy. Just come around that circle, head straight out the other side, and go straight.
It's beautiful, and simple words on those four panels read, "Gold Star Families, a tribute to those who sacrificed a loved one for our freedom." How would you describe the look of it? I mean, I'm looking at it right now. It's beautiful. How do you describe it, John?
I think the beauty of it is, and actually we'll take the back side of it, because there are four different messages that are on the back of the memorial. And the cutout of the soldier, there's actually a cutout in the granite of a soldier saluting. And one of the very nice things about positioning, Evan, is that if you stand in back of the memorial and look through that cutout, you look directly at the American flag over the Korean memorial. And so it's a very inspiring sight. But the four panels are meant to be simple, and they're meant to be all-inclusive, as Barry suggested. Gold Star Families is really the key issue here. Not just a Gold Star mom. And it's not to deny the mom, you know, at all. It's just to make sure that the grief and the pain for the entire family and all of the relatives are recognized as well.
Barry, when you decided to get on board with this, what did convince you? I mean, you're a man who has been asked to do a lot over the years. So why did you say yes to this?
Well, I think, Evan, I'm at the point in my life where I've long ago decided that I want to serve others, and I want to serve people with differing abilities. That's important to me through Al Siegel and other things. But I definitely want to serve veterans and their families. And I understand the ripple effect of losing a loved one. My cousin Jack was the seventh person from Rochester killed in the Battle of Yadrang, and I know how that affected our family. My Uncle Bill, as I mentioned, is missing. I have a second cousin who was 47, Gerald Colhane, who died in Vietnam. And the people who were left should have the opportunity to remember, and it ought to be something that they're proud of. While the pain needs healing, we need to commemorate those who died, and we need to continuously educate new generations about what this sacrifice means. It's something that's not easy to understand. It's not taught regularly everywhere. And until you get on the inside of something like this, you can't understand it. But by going to certain memorials, you can.
You remember losing your cousin Jack?
I sure do, because, you know, as a kid, when something happened that was really traumatic emotionally, you never forgot it. And I remember a chaplain and a uniformed person coming to the door, because my grandmother was living with us, and we were living in the 19th Ward at that time. And the door opening, my grandmother getting this terrible look on her face. My father, who had served 4 years in World War II, knew what it was about. And when they gave the condolences to my grandmother, she darn near passed out. And you know, he just cried, and it was terrible. I mean, it was for a kid, it was a terrifying experience. Mm. Not even understood fully, you know.
You were young?
Oh, I was six, yeah.
6 years old, yeah. And I don't even think I cannot relate to that in my own life, not at that age. But as you got older, what do you think about when you think about Jack then?
Well, I think about his family, that his four daughters had to grow up alone. He was an old guy compared to some of the others. He was 25 years old. I think about the fact that he was in the first air mobile attack, the Battle of Yadrang, and the book, Once We Were Soldiers. They actually, when they pan the name tags, they pan his name in the movie. And he was out trying to rescue a fellow soldier who was shot down and trying to drag him back, and he got killed.
So. And you said in Vietnam you lost, it was it a cousin, Uncle Gerald?
Jack was in Vietnam, but another cousin, Gerald Colhane, he was 45 or 47. And one of the older, really older guys who probably came back, I don't know for sure, but from Korea and then into Vietnam. But there are so many, in the building the Vietnam Memorial, there are so many parents and relatives that made me think that the Gold Star families was the move in the right direction away from just the moms. I think the moms seem to have suffered immensely, but I think the brothers and sisters didn't get the kind of recognition of the pain they went through. Hmm.
John, did you grow up losing anyone in service?
I don't recall. I don't think so. Yeah. Nobody that I knew of, so there was no family member. I remember my dad, those were the civil defense and the air defense days, and I remember living in the city, and my dad was the neighborhood air watch guy, so he'd put on his helmet and go out there and make sure everybody's shades were shut and the lights were off, and that was about as close to the military as we got as a family.
Yeah, I remember my Uncle Raleigh Kidder, who's former New York State Assemblyman and director of the Robert Jackson Center down in Jamestown. He wrote a book called Backtracking in Brown Water. He went back around 2010. He went back, he was in the Brown Water Navy, and he went back and decided 40 years later that he was going to go back, and he was going to retrace a lot of the route and see what he could find now. And then back stateside, he wanted to meet the families of the three people who had died alongside him and find out how their lives had changed. And he spent a long time tracking people down just to see the impact. And one of the lessons from what he put in that remarkable book was 40 years later, that loss is still so profound. I mean, Barry, you know, you're nodding right away here. I mean, sometimes we think of a loss, and mm-hmm. at least in the news, we report it as a brief incident. And it's easy for us to then move on and forget. And that book, to me, was just really stirring to think about what war has done for generations.
The scabs are very thin. That's it doesn't take much.
Yeah, that's a very important, too, Evan, important point. One of the whole primary issues around this memorial monument is that there's a lot of monuments and there's a lot of celebration sometimes around the troop itself. Around the death, around the occasion, quickly forgotten, almost always forgotten, was the family. And the focus was on the service person who lost their life. And so this whole issue, the pain lingers on for that family forever. There's an empty place at the table. There's a hole in the heart forever. And I think Woody Williams just, you know, God bless him. He did a wonderful job of saying, let's turn this into the Gold Star families.
We're talking about the Gold Star Family Memorial at Whitehaven Cemetery, which was dedicated in June of last year. And there's a great chance for you to get out. Well, you can see it really and observe and honor it at any time. But, you know, maybe a chance to go out and as John and Barry have said, maybe say a prayer on Memorial Day and think about families there. John, you know, living nearby, have you run into other families, you know, are you meeting people who are heading out there and kind of observing it in their own way?
I have met people out there. It's there's a nice bench sitting there just you know, to be able to meditate and be able to think through. And I've met a few families out there. One in particular that really struck me was a family. They live in Spencerport, and Madeline Teremy, she was the daughter. Her father was killed in Germany. Her mom was 3 months pregnant with her when her dad deployed. He was a B-24 pilot, first lieutenant. Once again, she never knew him, obviously. But the story of the family and the story that she shared is really quite tragic. Her dad and his crew, 9 people, on the flight, but her dad, Lieutenant Rogers, it was his first flight. There was a first combat mission that they had flown in their B-24, and they were shot down, captured by the Nazis, and they were on a train going to a prison camp, and the Americans, through the extensive bombing, had destroyed the train tracks. And so they had to get off the train, and the German soldiers marched them through a village to get to the other side where they could find adequate train transportation. While in the village, the civilians attacked the column. And although it sounds gruesome, the understanding is, the Americans have been bombing that area for days and days and weeks and destroying homes and businesses and costing lives. And so, understandably so, as you reflect upon it, the citizens were very, very angry and just brutal to the Americans. They attacked the Americans, and all were killed except one. One survived. Because he was appearing to be dead, they threw all of the bodies into a cart to haul them off to a grave site, and he was buried beneath them, and they never realized that he was still alive. Tragic story. But anyway, Madeline and her family at the memorial, just to encounter them, reflecting on that bench, was a very, very emotional moment for me.
When you hear a story like that, the families, I guess, they have to open up a lot just to even share that. And some are wanting to talk more, I think, than others, and understandably so. Every person grieves differently and heals differently over time. Does it have special meaning when they're willing to share that much with you, John?
I think it means a lot. I think we all indicate there's a brotherhood there, there's a bond, and they're willing to share all of that. One of the things that they also shared was that the town of, it was Rüsselsheim, Germany, just southwest of Frankfurt. Long after, this is just several years ago, invited she and the family back to apologize. And they actually have a monument in Rüsselsheim honoring the service of the American soldiers that were killed there. And which is really, quite remarkable when you think about it. And it's a very moving thing for them. And I think that was an expression that got her to open up, possibly, and share the story, because there's a healing there. There's a repair. And there's a regret for the fact that her dad and the other seven crewmen who were killed were in that circumstance.
The memorials make the loss tangible. And so that almost gives them permission to start talking about it, first among themselves and then among others who have had similar losses. And I think that that's all part of the healing process. And we've seen that time and time again at different memorials where it's the one place they might start to open up. And lately, the World War II veterans, as they get quite elderly, are starting to talk with one another, certainly with honor flight kinds of activities that opens that up. I think it's a really healthy thing and extremely meaningful. And when we see it, it makes all our work worthwhile.
There's a fascinating component to this story as well. Mm-hmm. The citizens were actually tried for war crimes, the ones that were directly involved in the murder of these servicemen. And they were tried by a lieutenant colonel in the Army named Leon Jaworski. And this is before the Nuremberg trials, and obviously before Leon Jaworski became a household name here in the United States as a special prosecutor. But he was the gentleman who prosecuted the citizens for war crimes in Rüsselsheim.
Wow. Well, and John, in the various notes you send along about, what's been going on with the Gold Star Family Memorial, you mentioned that there's occasionally some artifacts that people will come out with, flags, stone, things like that. What have you seen out there?
Yeah, it's quite impressive, actually. I think the first several times out there, I found money, coins, quarters and nickels and dimes. And what the significance of that is, Evan, I'm not sure, except that there's some contribution. There's some effort to, place something of value onto the memorial. And I wasn't there when any of them were placed, so I don't know the meaning or the issue behind them. The other thing that touched me, which goes back to the Jewish cemetery tradition, is little stones. on the memorial. And I think, as most know, the Jewish tradition of placing a stone on the headstone of someone who has passed is a remembrance that we were there and that you're not alone. And I think that's a key message. You're not alone. And that little stone just means, you know, I'm here, I'm thinking about you, and it's a very, very wonderful thing.
You know, that's true, too, for the people who helped us really put this together. There was a lot of in-kind service. You know, Whitehaven's a great partner to work with. They take great pride in that memorial, as they do the Korean Memorial. And JL and Chuck Reagan take care of it every day. We've really had Sal Labello, Sergio Esteban, Jennifer Leonard from Rochester Community
Foundation.
Foundation, thank mm-hmm. you, Evan. They helped us not to have to put together a separate 501c3, but just to, another one, but just to build the memorial and be done with it. And then Whitehaven took it over. But Wolcott Construction and Wayside Garden, Lisa's Liquor Barn, CMI Communications, on and on and on. This Rochester community is fantastic in terms of teaming up with folks who want to accomplish a bigger cause.
And Whitehaven itself is a beautiful place.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, John. Go ahead, John.
A lot of people ask us early on why Whitehaven, or they recommended certain sites that they thought would be appropriate for it. We selected Whitehaven on a pretty strict set of criteria, all of which they glowingly supported. It's a reverent environment out there. It's a very veteran-friendly. They go way over the top in terms of their service to veterans and their honor to veterans in terms of special sections and the ability to put a monument there. They came up with a site, Evan, that if you think about a contribution of a site that is prime property for them to put this memorial and not stick it back in a corner somewhere or not, oh yeah, but we've got some place that, you know, we don't really have an opportunity to sell many grave sites in. This is an absolutely beautiful and perfect place for it. And they, without hesitation or without question, wanted this to be a wonderful opportunity for people to see it. There's great parking there. There's great access. It's off a couple of expressways right there on Marsh Road in the village or in Pittsford. And anyway, I can't say enough about Andrea Vittem and J.L. McInerney and Chuck Reagan, who's our facilities manager. Those folks, they were partners.
Well, you can observe it now as we observe this Memorial Day. The Gold Star Family Memorial at Whitehaven Cemetery was dedicated in June of last year. So you get a chance to understand just exactly the reverence that our guests are talking about. John White and Barry Culhane talking about it. Let's get a short break and right back with them on Connections. Welcome back to Connections on this Memorial Day. Nice to have John and Barry with us. And I'd like to shift and just talk a little bit about their own service. And, you know, I've got some notes on some of the service that John's giving me a little bit of a scowl there. But let me ask both of you a question for starters, because my father was an MP serving around the time that both of you did, I think. And, you know, I realized just a few years ago, I don't think he's ever really talked much about it. And I don't know that he won't if I asked him. And Dad, if you're listening in Cleveland, let's talk sometime about it. If you want to. If, I say if you want to, because, you know, we've had veterans on this program who tell us it took decades before I could even talk about certain experiences. And then others who say it's cathartic and it feels good to talk about it because it means someone is listening and someone cares and that you feel less isolation. So, John, I'll start with you. Is your service something that you have been able, and I don't know if eager is the right word, but something that you've wanted to talk about over the years? How do you feel about it?
Actually, over the years, not at all.
No.
Didn't say a word. In fact, now is we've kind of opened up the door a little bit. My wife is always surprised. Sandy will say, you know, you've never shared that, but I had a situation about 4 years ago that opened the door. A teacher at Pittsford Sutherland High School was teaching a class in military history, and one of the whole sections was about Vietnam. And so he invited me in, and I was very reluctant, Evan. never having spoken to it, and now I've got a group of high school students, and you don't know how they're going to react to it, because it's, you know, the reaction that we've gotten from a Vietnam returnee standpoint hasn't always been good.
Yeah.
But I went in and I made that presentation. Those high school students were so respectful. Their questions were on point, penetrating. Their reaction to some of the harsher parts of my experience in combat was excellent. And I walked away from that and said, you know, I think they learned something, and I think it's healthy for them to learn something about the service and that type of a thing. So that was kind of the door opener for me, and that was probably 4 years ago.
Do you find it easier to talk about now because of that opened the door?
Yes, I do.
So you don't mind if I ask you just a few questions? I was going to say, I want to ask both of you this before I really kind of dig into the service. I was going to say thank you for your service. I'll tell you, I hear from a number of veterans, certainly not universally, but from some who say, please don't say that. And we've, you know, asked over the years, well, why is it that you say you don't want me to say thank you for your service? And sometimes I've been told, well, that it's code for thank you for doing what I didn't have to do, or, you know, something along the lines of it being insulting. And all I will say is I never want to insult. So if I thank you for your service, I hope it's not insulting at all. How do you take it, John?
No, I take it fine. It never bothers me at all. Thank you for your service is an honor. If it is an issue where I didn't have to serve and I'm glad you did, you know what, that's okay with me. So I don't mind it at all. Thank you for serving. Thank you for your service. I accept every comment about that.
Okay, Barry?
Absolutely. We didn't start saying it soon enough. And those who might have a negative reaction to it, I personally don't understand. Here you have a person who hasn't maybe had a relationship with the military, but really genuinely does appreciate the fact that you served.
Sure.
I can't see a negative in that. I've never had that experience of, you know, feeling like somebody said, ha, you had to serve.
I mean, that's what I say to police officers when I shake their
hands. Absolutely.
I find myself compelled to say thank you for your service when I'm talking to someone who is currently or has been engaged in an activity to protect people, mm-hmm. when there may be imminent physical harm. And yes, I'm not a police officer, and I have not had to, you know, I've not been drafted. I mean, we are a privileged generation, no doubt about it. But I feel compelled to say thank you for that, because that is a level of danger, personal peril, that I can't imagine. So that's what I say to police officers. It's what I say to veterans. So anyway, so I guess I just wanted to air that out, only because whenever we have these kind of conversations on the show, we inevitably hear from some listeners who will say, it kind of admonish us, please don't say that. So listeners, especially our veteran listeners, if that is bothersome to you, I apologize, but I just kind of wanted to air that out a little bit. So John, for you, your service in the U.S. Marine Corps, 66 to 73?
That is correct.
And kind of take us back to the route that you took in service.
Well, it's interesting. I was originally going to join the Navy. And I know there's all kinds of war stories out there about the relationship between the Navy and the Marine Corps. But
true or hyperbole?
Hyperbole.
Okay.
Very much hyperbole. There's a lot of respect and there's a lot of honor that goes between those two services. But the all through college, I had a bent towards the military, and my goal was to become a Navy flight officer. And I passed all of my exams, all of the tests, everything was wonderful. And about March of my senior year, they sent me down to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio for my final physical, and I flunked the hearing test.
The hearing test?
The hearing test. And
did that surprise you?
Well,
did you have trouble hearing?
No, it did surprise me. I had trouble in a little surgery as a kid to correct a problem.
Okay.
But I didn't have any issues around hearing. I mean, I thought I was fine. So I flunked the hearing test, and so I got washed out of the Navy flight opportunity. I took a job, an administrative job. Did that for about 6 months. Absolutely hated the shuffling of papers, mm-hmm. from one side of the desk to the other. Well, I was a junior admin guy, you know. And so I enlisted in the Marine Corps. And I said, if I can't be a Navy pilot, then I'm gonna join the best ground-pounding service there is in the world. And so I enlisted in the Marine Corps.
And I know eventually you suffered serious injury, but before then, you know, how would you describe your experience in your service?
I thought it was outstanding. The training, the officer's candidate course down at Quantico was absolutely outstanding. I think I thrived in that environment. I probably needed the discipline, and I walked.
Why do you say that?
Well, I was a little bit off the wall as a teenager, and so I think I needed the discipline, and I enjoyed it. I thrived in it. I then went on to the basic school, which is advanced infantry training for the Marine Corps. That's 6 months. So you're an officer, you're a second lieutenant, you go to this basic school, and I thrived in that environment. I graduated first in my class. And as a result of that, which is sometimes challenged by some of my friends, but as first in my class, I had the option to choose any duty station in the world. That was available, of course, but I had my option for embassy duty and ceremonial duty and all kinds of things. And I chose Vietnam to be a Marine Corps infantry officer in 1966. The place to be was Vietnam. I was well-trained, I was well-skilled, and I was anxious to serve the country and go to Vietnam.
Do you know, just offhand, even a guess, how many people who graduated first in their class chose Vietnam?
Quite a few.
Quite a few, you think?
Quite a few. And quite a few had no choice. the war was raging in 1966, so quite a few did not have a choice. But there were some that had tested in a specific interest for flight or for artillery or tanks or, some of these other, elements of occupation in the Marine Corps. But we had 543 second lieutenants in our graduating class from the basic school, and I would guess that somewhere around 450 of them got assigned to Vietnam.
Yeah. Do you remember what your mentality was going there in 1966?
My mentality was I was there to serve, and I was there to do my job, and I was there to lead the most extraordinary group of young men that I will ever encounter. Those Marine Corps troops were just absolutely wonderful kids, and there was no mistake about it. In fact, some people, you look at missional issues, Evan, in terms of what your real job is. My job was through skill and through, cajoling and architecture of whatever I could think of. My job was to get them all home.
We had a conversation recently with 94-year-old Pete Dupre, a World War II veteran, and he told us about not only why he still wants to attend as many honor flight ceremonies as he can at the airport, but especially for those who served in Vietnam, because he said it was so difficult to see fellow Americans coming home and occasionally, first of all, really never getting the parade and that kind of actual public appreciation, but sometimes derision. Were you aware of that when that was going on, John, at the time, or were you kind of focused on what you were doing there?
No, I was aware of it. And once again, the families were very, very different during the Vietnam era. And I had a brother who was actually on his way to Canada to avoid the draft. And I don't know that he ever burned a flag, but he must have come very close. So I had a brother that was on the complete opposite side of the issue, Evan. And right within a family, that's not only painful, but the awareness level is very high. And so, yes, I was aware of it. One of the other things about the honor flight, as you mentioned, this gentleman, one of the things that a lot of Vietnam veterans say to each other is welcome home. Not thank you for your service or thank you for serving, but welcome home. And the reason that's said is because we never got welcomed home. It was almost avoided as a topic. Sandy, my wife, lived here in Rochester while I was deployed to Vietnam. None of her friends, none of anybody she taught with or had a social engagement with had anybody serving. And she was alone, and she had no support system, and nobody even talked to about it. So welcome home is an appropriate phrase, too. And the honor flight just brings to bear a ceremony and a celebration of the fact that, notwithstanding what your job was or where your location was, we honor the service that you gave to this great country of ours.
Yeah, I think of my father, who was an MP, and in his family, there was a conscientious objector. And I think probably there were more families than we realized who were kind of pulled and split in that way. And so, yeah, very emotional time from what my family has described to me in that way. So, so let's talk about what ended up happening to you and what you went through. I guess I'll just ask it broadly, John, what happened?
Yeah. My tour in Vietnam ended I was wounded, seriously wounded. We were on a battalion level exercise, and we encountered a regiment of North Vietnamese regulars coming out of Laos, and it was a tough fight. It was a tough day, and lost some men, which gives me great incentive and encouragement when you talk about getting started with the Gold Star Memorial. First of all, as you well know, when Barry Culhane asks, no is not an option.
I am aware. I can relate to that.
No, there is no option for no. But the other issue is the sensitivity of those families for the men that I knew and I lost. One other short story, as I was wounded very, very severely, and there was some confusion as to whether or not I was alive. And the pain of picturing this is my wife, house on Harvard Street, living with her parents, side panels of glass on each side of the door and a big window in the front door. And the doorbell rings one day after she's home from school, and there stands a Navy chaplain and a Marine Corps officer in uniform on the front porch. And I think by the look in your eyes, you know what that normally means.
Yeah.
And just the agony of having her go through that. They were able to announce and confirm that I was alive. But boy, I think about that, Evan, and I think about the issue of Gold Star families and how close we came.
So I guess if I'm understanding correctly, John, they at least had a brief moment where they had to wonder, are they here because John's gone?
That is correct.
Now, but they were told pretty quickly, he has survived it, but he's been severely injured.
Correct.
Oh my, yeah, just that moment of wonder.
Yeah, I often say to people that in our family, the absolute worst and most agonizing part of the Vietnam War was Sandy answering in that front door.
Yeah. So you were ended up in needing a lot of care, I understand, yeah?
Yes.
How severe were the injuries?
I was actually hit by a machine gun in the trade. I got stitched, which veterans will understand.
Yeah.
Yes. And so I got hit with a machine gun, and as I often joke, the good news is it was lower left to upper right. Because if it had been the other way around, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation. But I had several gunshot wounds, and then because we were under intense enemy fire, under a very superior force at that time, we did finally take fire control, however. I was there for quite some time, and then I also suffered some mortar and grenade shrapnel to the chest. And so I had a series of wounds for the gunshot wounds as well as the shrapnel wounds. And finally got extracted and evacuated and went through a series of naval hospitals and spent quite a bit of time in Yokosuka, Japan, wonderful hospital. But then most of my major surgeries were done at the Portsmouth Naval Hospital.
And how long until, I guess, you felt like you could have a normal physical day without pain and without, I mean, you look great today. How long was it for you?
Thank you to the Navy doctors and nurses.
Yeah.
It was quite a while, quite frankly. And one of the things that, after 14 months, I was on limited duty. They don't take you out of the hospital and put you on full duty. So they put you on limited duty. And, this is interesting. You make decisions in your life, but you can't get promoted when you're on limited duty. And I was in grade and up for promotion to captain. And so I signed a waiver, a health waiver, that I was fine so I could get promoted to captain. and to this day, Evan, and Barry knows this in his heart, the pride in my life having been a captain in the United States Marine Corps is immense and doesn't wither ever.
Well, now let me say in total sincerity, thank you for your service, and I'm in awe of your family for what they were able to endure as well. And John will tell you too. I mean, you spend 5 minutes with John, and John clearly would rather talk about other people, which is why when I asked you about what you went through, you immediately talked about the people you lost that day, before getting to your story. But just amazing to hear what Gold Star families go through as well. So, Barry Culhane, I'll turn to you and ask you kind of your own feelings about telling the story. Of what you endured and mm-hmm. and served.
Well, I put myself in the category of someone who just signed an oath that said I would do everything up to including giving my life, and I was one of the very fortunate people who did not, which is also motivates me to help deal with memorials. But before I go on, I want to mention just one person in town. There are so many people that are around us every day that you might not realize some of their past. But a good friend of mine, Bob Dobies, was a captain in the Marine Corps, and Bob chairs the Rochester Regional Health Board. He's probably one of the greatest patriots that I know. And he doesn't talk about anything. But he really is a hero's hero, as is John. If you earn a Silver Star, or in Gary Bikerk's case, a Medal of Honor, you are a special individual. Now, I did not serve in combat, so there's this feeling among veterans that if you served in combat and you lost some of your friends, you still weren't as good as they were, who gave the ultimate sacrifice. Then you move to the next level of comparative levels of being wounded, and then comparative levels of serving here and there, numbers of tours, so on and so forth. So there's this unspoken kind of lining up of veterans.
Is it a guilt?
I call it a line of guilt. So if you didn't pay the ultimate sacrifice, you were on that line of guilt, and then it goes down mm-hmm. from there. So for me, my experience was as a medic. I was first a combat medic, but I was on orders for Vietnam with 5 days to go, and they got pulled. It was when Nixon was pulling back orders. I spent some time in Brooke Army Hospital dealing with napalm victims. So that was about as close as I got to really seeing the damages of war. And John knows I say that I know the difference between a good day and a bad day, and I've never had a bad day compared to these guys.
Oh boy.
For those who made it through the treatments, I don't know how they didn't stay alive and not take their lives. So for me, it was a relatively easy tour, certainly compared to John's or a lot of other people. I think maybe it's because I was in that situation that it made me appreciate more the things that happened to me and the things I was able to do. I was actually in college in Canada, and I think I was the only one who came back. But I wasn't
coming the other way.
I wasn't going to have my dad and my uncle.
So you were coming back, and all the conscientious objectors were going the other way.
Let me tell you, the flow was definitely in the other direction.
Barry, is there anything that prepares somebody to deal with someone who is a victim of napalm?
I don't think there's much. There's certainly it's one of the things you never forget. You never forget the odors and the pain. You know, taking away dead flesh when you know that all the morphine in the world isn't going to help that guy, and the disfigurement is beyond belief. Really,
I wonder. Also, I mean, just probably in those moments, you're just doing what you can to help somebody. But it makes me sad that the human condition is still that we could do this to each other in the 20th century and into the 21st century. And you wonder, are we ever going to get over this?
I really think those thoughts myself, Evan, because I don't know how in your right mind you could behead someone or pour napalm over them or do all these other things. I don't get it. And we know that it happens. We were talking a little bit today about World War I and the use of poison gas. How can human beings do that to one another? I don't quite understand it.
Are you an optimist that we will ever see a generation that comes with minimal war?
I'm an optimist in that regard. I think there are going to be times of relative peace. But it's partly because of my faith, and I think that God can't possibly look over a world in so much disruption and killing.
How do you feel, John?
I think, I don't know that I'm quite as optimistic in the near term, but I think I believe, Evan, that there's a crescendo, or there's a tidal wave, if you will, of this violence, that at some point we're all going to wake up. And I don't know when that point is. I don't think it's the next few years, but we're going to wake up and say, you know, this is just not going to continue to happen. And so I believe we're cresting, if that's an appropriate term. And I think we're going to get a lot smarter and a lot more able to communicate with all different factions. I look at the children today, and you look at the education today. Talk about multicultural, multiracial, all of these issues. I think we're going to come together with a much better level-headed communication.
Well, and by the way, Barry, thank you for your service as well. And I know what you're talking about. I mean, that's one of the few things my father has talked about, is some of the guilt that you feel when you know someone didn't come home that you served with, or you didn't serve as long, or they served more tours, or they were more exposed to combat. But, you know, that just shows what a big person you are to line yourself up that way. And I'll just say thank you for your service. And John?
Thank you. Well, I want to throw this at Barry, because he certainly deserves it. When you talk about the different levels of service, if you will, or people who want to, discriminate against certain levels, Barry founded an organization here in Rochester called One Team, One Fight. And One Team, One Fight goes across all of the services, and it goes across whether you were located in, you know, Alabama or, you know, Octon Bar or wherever you were, whatever service you were in or whatever location you were in, it's One Team, One Fight. And it's like an organism. If you have a part of it that doesn't function, then the rest of it suffers. And so whether we were on the ground in combat, whether you were in a supply chain in Albany, Georgia, whether you were in a hospital, in a napalm clinic, you know, wherever you were, it's all part of the system. And it is One Team, One Fight, and this gentleman founded that.
Thank you, Barry. Last question for you, and I don't mean to make it controversial, but it's a serious question given the service and the sacrifice that particularly your generation had to endure, and mine has not, given the fact that there is no draft. Is there a benefit to the public for that? Will we ever see it come back, and should we? Barry?
Oh, definitely. We should definitely have a draft come back, but it should come back in a different format, because there are so many things that need to be accomplished in society that goes well beyond the military. We need to really take on K-12 education and win that battle, because we're losing it. And it's probably one of the most important that we have. So if somebody wants to come back and get drafted, they should have four or five different opportunities to serve this country. But I really believe we need people to serve causes larger than themselves. I think they need to have an experience for at least 2 years giving of oneself to some part of society that's going to improve.
John?
I agree 100%. One of the things that they talk about with the draft is you would lower the quality of the military service, because right now, as an all-volunteer service, you have people who are actually elected to be there. I can assure you from a Vietnam experience and from all of my years in the United States Marine Corps, when the draft was in fact there, you know what? You get drafted, you go in, you take the oath, and they did their job, and they did it beautifully. And so I don't see any lack of loyalty or any lack of performance, whether you have or do not have a draft. But the issue around that Barry discusses of maybe five different options, one of which is military, but the ability to give service to this country and the ability to understand what that means for yourself and for others sets a value system for your lifestyle. And I agree with that 100%.
John White and Barry Culhane are here telling us the story of the Gold Star Family Memorial at Whitehaven Cemetery and kind enough to answer some questions about their own remarkable service. So thank you to them. In particular, thank you to Gold Star families. And if you head out to Whitehaven Cemetery and you want to say a prayer and think about them, it's at the Gold Star Family Memorial is there. It was dedicated in June 2016. And John and Barry are just two of the people behind that, but they mentioned the many people involved, many organizations. Barry, thank you. It's always great to see you.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you so much. And John, really enjoyed the conversation, and I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our thanks to the entire production team here at Connections. Engineer Rob Braden, producer Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Wherever you are on this Memorial Day, hope it's a peaceful one for you. And we'll talk to you Tuesday on member-supported public radio.